The Working of Sovereign Grace, an exposition of Genesis chapters 42 through 44. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, November the 10th, 2010.
Have you noticed that nobody has to be convinced or coerced into sharing good news? You know, you have a baby born in the family, whether it's a child or grandchild, you even argue over who gets to tell it. You know, I'm going to call so-and-so. No, you call the last one. It's my turn to call. You let a guy get a new car, he has to tell everybody about his car. And he tells perfect strangers about the car. People with good news can really be annoying. Don't you find yourself sometimes looking them in the eye, and you don't say it, you're just thinking it. I know this means a lot to you, but I'm really not interested. Yet at the same time, there is joy in sharing someone else's joy. There is something about celebrating good news with other folks, especially when it comes to the gospel, especially when it comes to rejoicing in the work of God in the hearts of His people. There is great joy in that. I love the translation of Psalm 107 out of the New Living Translation. Give thanks to the Lord, for He's good. His faithful love endures forever. Has the Lord redeemed you? Then speak out. Tell others He has saved you from your enemies. King James says, let the redeemed of the Lord say so. If you've been saved, if the Lord's done a work in your life, then tell somebody. Speak out about it. Be quick to share. Peter said, we need to always be ready to give a reason for the hope that's in us. There's something that is comforting and encouraging about sharing about God's work. And so I want to take just a minute this evening and see if any of you would share with us your experience of how you came to faith in Christ. There are those times when it's just an encouragement for us to hear about how God orchestrated events. So if you'd share just how you came to know the Lord, just raise your hand, say, I want to share, and share. Anybody? Jerry.
Well, I was fortunate when I grew up in a Christian home, but I was never saved until I was 18. And, you know, I had walked the aisle before, but there was no change. I mean, I knew that. But I'd come to move to Tulsa, and Lisa and I had been dating for not too long, and went to listen to Bailey Smith downtown at the convention center. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was as good as a back row Baptist as there was. I found the furthest seat I could find, just happened to be right in the aisle. Because it was about the furthest back you could get. Well, that night is when I realized that I was going to hell, and that Christ was the only thing that would really mean anything to me, and that if I didn't accept it right then, I wasn't getting an opportunity. And I don't know if that's true, but that's how I felt. And that night I accepted Christ. And it was long before I ever left the city. And it wasn't when I was walking down the aisle, it was in the seat before I ever took a step.
Wow. Thanks. Somebody else. Anybody else? Richard?
I was saved because I finally started listening to a good preacher. He was always a good preacher. I just wouldn't listen.
I was going to say, who was he? We need to write.
It was Carl Chisholm.
Oh, okay.
He did a good job, and I finally started paying attention.
Okay. Somebody else? Nancy?
Thank you.
That's a good name for a preacher, isn't it, Divine? Because most of us are. Okay, somebody else? Marilyn, go ahead. Anybody else want to share their story? John.
I started dating Marie April 19, 1952, and she wouldn't go out to movies or something with anybody. I didn't go to church with her. And so we argued almost every night about whether I was saved or not. I thought I was good enough, I'd get to heaven. And July 6th, that year, 12 days before we got married,
Lord, the
major
Baptist
church. Mm-hmm. Great. I was sitting down in West Tulsa on the Eugene Field school grant in a tent revival. And when I was 12 years old. And we had a lot of members out here who were members down there. Old Jimmy Dean,
Yeah, been a couple.
Yeah. Jimmy Dean was my Sunday school teacher out of Maine before I was saved.
Okay, anybody else want to share? Keith. It's just an encouragement to me, and I think it's always an encouragement for us as a people when we just think about God's working and how gracious and merciful, but also how varied it is. How we're all at different places and how the Lord uses different kinds of influences, and whether it's a friend, whether it's through a pastor preaching, an evangelist, whether it is through the faithful witness of a spouse, whether it's the influence of the home you grew up in. I'm grateful that I grew up in a home that was faithful in the attendance of the church and their love for the church, and it went back into my grandparents and their faithfulness as well. And I can remember vividly, Carl Chisholm was my pastor as well. And I can remember the way he dealt with children, and it still influences the way I deal with children today, because I can remember my mom taking me in to see him during the week and going into his office, and he's just asking me very open-ended questions. He didn't stand me in front of a congregation and say to me with his head nodding, "You believe you're a sinner? You believe that Jesus died?" Because a kid's going to absolutely whatever you say. He just asked me questions. What is sin? What does it mean to sin? What does God think about sin? And those type of questions. And I can remember he didn't even offer to lead me in a prayer or anything. He got through asking me questions and he said, "Thanks, why don't you go out and play?" And I left the room. I only found out later what he did. And he talked to my mom and said he has sufficient understanding as I see it, and just wait and let the Lord bring him to himself in his time. And it was some time later in a service that I looked at my dad and said, "You know, I want to go." And he very lovingly said, "I told you to do that before the service." I said, "No, that's not what I mean." And my father walking me down the aisle to meet the pastor, and we knelt and prayed at Carbondale Baptist Church there, and how I gave my heart to the Lord. It's the Lord is gracious and merciful, and He comes to us in different ways, but there are some factors that are all the same. We rejoice in the goodness and grace of God, but we recognize it is God who does the work of salvation. And God uses various means, and He uses various people, and He brings us to Himself in various ways, but it is always God who does the work. It is God who awakens us. It is God who makes us aware. When we think of salvation, we're naturally drawn to the New Testament. It's there we read the Gospels. It's there that we find those passages in the Gospels and the epistles that remind us that salvation is by grace alone, through faith alone, because of Christ alone. It's there in Acts that we see all of those examples of conversion. But salvation is not a New Testament thing. It's a biblical thing. And God has been in the business of saving people all along. So tonight, I want us to look at an Old Testament passage as an illustration, as a picture of how God brings people to salvation. The story of Joseph is a fascinating story. By the time we come to Genesis 42, it's been 22 years since his brothers sold him into slavery. And over that 22 years, it's been a roller coaster. He rises to a level of prominence, and then things plunge back down. And then he rises again, and things plunge back down. He was sold to a group of traveling salesmen. He's taken down to Egypt. He's sold again. There he eventually rises to a place of prominence within the house of Potiphar. Then, because he refused the advances of Potiphar's wife, he is falsely accused and falsely imprisoned. And there he languishes in prison until one day some cabinet-level officials end up in his jail cell. They happen to have dreams, and he understood the dreams. He was able to interpret them for them. And God used all of that. God was orchestrating all of these events. And then he tells the cupbearer to be sure and remember him when he comes back into prominence. Oh, you bet. He's forgotten, left to languish another 2 years. Then Pharaoh has a dream, and nobody's able to understand it. And they say, "Oh, I remember a guy who's able to interpret dreams." And so he moves from the prison to the palace. He goes from being a prisoner to being prime minister in a single day. Now he's married to a woman who is a part of a very prominent Egyptian family. He is prime minister of the land. He has two sons of his own. Now that great famine that was part of Pharaoh's dream has come about, and people are coming from all over to buy grain in Egypt. And guess what happens? His brothers come down to Egypt, and they bow at his feet as they come seeking grain. Do you remember the original dream that started this whole business? He said to his brothers, I got to tell you this great dream. We all had these sheaves of wheat, and yours all bowed down to mine. He had another dream. He said, well, the stars all bowed down, including the sun and the moon. Mom and Dad and all of you are going to bow before me. Didn't go over well. But now there he is. Who would have ever dreamed this is the way that's going to work out? Now here's the amazing thing. His brothers are there. They're bowing at his feet. It's the fulfillment of the dream. This has all been God's working, God's business. But he doesn't tell them it's him. He recognizes them. They don't recognize him. And rather than tell them who he was. Now, again, this is one of those places where I've got to be honest. I think I would have had to tell them. I think I would have absolutely loved the opportunity to tell them. And I would have said something like, you know, guys, I told you years ago this was going to happen. That would have been the perfect opportunity to rub their nose in it. And I have to be honest enough to say, I think I would have relished rubbing my brother's noses in it. He didn't. He didn't rub their nose in it. But at the same time, he treated them roughly. He didn't immediately love them and be gracious and understanding to them either. Why? God is at work in all of this. God is orchestrating all the events. And as we walk through chapter 42, 43, and 44, I want us to see something of the work of God in all of it. As we're reminded that salvation is the result of the working of God's sovereign grace. There are elements throughout this story that reflect the work of God in the life of these brothers. First, we're going to look in chapter 42 at verse 1 down through verse 23 and the working of God's grace, awakening a genuine sense of need. When we first look through these chapters, it really appears that all that's going on is there's famine and there's need for food, but there's more to the story. Throughout the whole life of Joseph, we keep finding that there's more to the story than just what's on the surface. The whole story of Joseph is the story of God's sovereignty. The reason the brothers are upset is not just because Joseph happened to be favored. It is that he's favored of God. It is that he has been given by God a place over them. And they're rebelling not just against Joseph. They're rebelling against God. We have to put the story in the context of their reaction to that story, their reaction to the vision that God had given. God is sovereign. He is working all of this, and He is directing this drama. God is the central actor in all of it. He placed Joseph in Egypt. He saw to it that he would be placed in prison. He arranged for his cellmates. He gave them dreams. He gave to him the interpretation of dreams. It is God who caused the cupbearer to forget. It is God who caused Pharaoh to dream and then to give Joseph the interpretation. It is God who brought Joseph to power, and it is God who caused the famine to be throughout the whole region. Why? Because it all worked according to his purpose. God was at work in all of it. We live in a world where we commonly say, boy, he's lucky. Boy, chances, he took a chance on that. And we talk in terms of luck and chance, but we really understand that we as believers don't believe in luck or chance. We believe in providence. We believe that God's hand is involved in all things. And that's certainly true of the whole life of Joseph, and it's profoundly true about this experience in these chapters and what God is doing. The truth of the matter is, even as you shared your stories, if you reflect back on your life and you look at how you came to faith in Christ and you look specifically at the events surrounding that, then you have to understand that God works all of it. He worked the circumstance of your life. He worked incidences in your life, people that you came in contact with, people that led to decisions you made. All of it, whether you were a child, whether you were an adult, all the things that happened that led up to your coming to faith in Christ, God arranged the circumstance. He put you in the exact place you needed to be at the time you needed to be there in order for you to come to a saving knowledge of Him, and that also prepared you for what was yet to come. God is sovereign, and He's merciful, He's gracious, and He's kind. And it is the work of God that brings life eternal and life abundant. I want you to keep that in mind as we work our way through this. When we read the story of Jacob, we know that Jacob wasn't a nice guy. If we had our choice between Jacob and Esau, most of us would choose Esau. If we had to have a friend, we would probably prefer Esau to Jacob. Jacob is a liar. Jacob is a deceiver. He is a supplanter. That's what his name means. His name means to cheat. His name means to supplant or to deceive. When we look at his sons, they were a chip off the old block. We remember that it was Simeon and Levi who, for the revenge of the rape of their sister Dinah, slaughtered the men of the entire city, then led their brothers in plundering that city. It was Judah, another of the sons, who cheated and deceived his daughter-in-law Tamar out of her having the family that was due her, and then had sexual relations with her, thinking her a prostitute. Then these brothers sought to kill their little brother, then decided they would just sell him. They're a nice bunch of fellas. They're a group of hardened men. What we need to understand is these heads of the tribes of Israel were a godless bunch. By the time we get to this point in the story, there has been no reference, none, prior to this of their having any love for God or their worshiping or their serving Him. Not any reference to their love for God. In fact, you remember when Jacob started back home, he had to say to all of these boys and their families, "Now you need to get rid of your idols." They were a godless bunch, and it's evidenced in all of their acts. Now there's this famine. Now is there this growing sense of need. They come down to Egypt, and they find some harsh treatment. Look, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 42. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" In other words, what are you doing standing here? You know we're not getting anywhere. You know we're not going to get any food. Nothing's going to happen here. "Behold, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, along with the others for fear that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over all the land, and it was he who sold to all the peoples of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where do you come from?" They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." Again, Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dream that he had had. And he said to them, "You're spies. You have come to seek the nakedness of the land." They said, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." "No, it's the nakedness of the land that you've come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. Behold, the youngest is this day with his father, and one is no more." Joseph said to them, "It is as I said, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here." You're spies. I suspect that he's using their own words against them. You remember when he came out to check on them? I think that's probably what they said to him. Are you here to spy on us? You here to tell Daddy what's going on? You're his favorite. You know, you're wearing that special little coat that he gave you and all of that. You're a spy. Why don't you get out of here, you spy? I think he's turning it on him now. Now, you're here to spy out the land. You're here to use trickery. You're here to destroy. You're not here for honest reason. Don't you love their answer? Oh, no, we're honest men. We're not spies. We are all sons of the same man back in Canaan. There are 12 of us, and the youngest is there with his father. One isn't anymore. The 10 of us remain. No, you're spies. See, I think they were uneasy whenever Jacob said, go down to Egypt. Because I think every time they heard the word Egypt, it gave them a knot in their stomach. I think they couldn't help but wonder, whatever happened to Joseph? Is he still alive? What's happened to him? What's going on with him? He decides to put him in prison for 3 days in verse 17. What do you think went on in that time? What do you think ran through their mind during that? Then he goes down and he tells them, okay, I'm going to let you out, but here's what I'm going to require of you. You're going to need to leave one of you here. The rest of you go back with grain and then come back. Look at what they say. And still in prison, in verse 21, they said to one another, in truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. There is an awakening. There is a beginning to understand on their part. And probably, really, for the first time, at least it's the first time we're given any reference, they are connecting punishment with their actions. Salvation is the work of God, and the beginning of that process is an awakening to a sense of need. It is an awakening, a connecting our sin with a sense of judgment, with a sense of righteous judgment, with a sense that God is fair and just in doing so, but we're really beginning to awaken to the fact that there is great need. We're beginning to awaken to the fact that there is sin and that sin has to be dealt with. A second step. The working of God's grace opens blind eyes to the reality of the presence of God. Okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to leave one here. We'll bind Simeon. We're going to hold him here. The rest of you take the grain and go back home. Then you bring your brother back and we'll take care of the greater needs. So they're sending them off, but there's a shocking revelation that comes to them. Joseph gave instruction. Give them the grain, send them on their way, and put their money back in the sacks. They're out. They're on the road. They're heading back home. One of them stops to take some grain out of the sack to feed his donkey, and he makes a discovery. Look, chapter 42, verse 27. And as one of them opened his sack and gave his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. He said to his brothers, my money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of the sack. At this their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? Okay, there was the beginning of an awakening. This has come upon us because of our actions. This is punishment. This distress that we're in, the fact that we're in prison, and all of this is coming on us, it's all because our brother begged us and we didn't have the heart to listen. Our brother begged us for his life. He begged us not to do it. We turned a deaf ear. We refused to listen. We are rightly being judged. We are rightly coming under this distress because of our actions. Now it's a step further. They're connecting it directly with God. What is God doing? Salvation is the work of God, and as God begins this work of salvation in us, He brings us to an awakening of our need. He brings us to an awakening of what we are and where we are, and then He brings us to an awareness of His presence. And consciousness of the presence of God is not always a comforting thing. Sometimes it is a very disturbing thing. It depends on where you stand in relation to Him. When you are His child and there is great distress in your life, it is a comforting thing to be aware of the presence of God. When you are a sinner and you know you are deserving of His wrath and judgment, it's a very uncomfortable thing to be aware of the presence of God. They were terrified. But this is a new thing for them. They weren't terrified of God before. They weren't conscious of God before. There's been no reference to their being aware or being concerned or caring anything about the presence of God. God is at work. They had heard stories. They heard stories from their father. They were aware of what happened at Jabbok. They heard other stories that their father shared with them about the presence of God. But this was a new experience for them. An awakening of their need, an awareness of the presence of God. And one other thing, we find it in chapter 43. The working of God's grace lovingly brings us to the end of ourselves. They got home, told their father their story. Eventually, the grain runs out, and they have to go back to Egypt. Go back and get more grain. Dad, we can't. We can't go back without Benjamin. If we go back, we have to take Benjamin, or they'll not see us. They'll treat us harsh. Now, all the time you're wondering, what about Simeon? He's still there. And it's been a long time. And no one's come back. It's time to go back, and they are told, go back and do whatever you must. Judah says, let Benjamin go and hold me accountable, hold me responsible. If I don't bring him back, you make me pay. You put it upon me. If I don't come back, you put it upon my family. They come back and they find Joseph loving and understanding, but they still don't know who he is. They're perplexed because they don't understand why there would be this loving acceptance on the part of this Egyptian. But it's a picture of God's grace. It isn't owed. We have no right to it. We have no claim to it. But God is merciful. His brothers receive love and grace from Joseph without the knowledge of who he is. So it is with us before our knowledge of Christ. He is gracious, he is merciful, he is kind, but we don't understand it. It is the goodness of God that leads us to repentance. So we preach Christ. And we offer grace and mercy to those who are in their sin because of Christ. They're allowed to leave. Again, they're given ample provision. But this time, a silver cup is placed in Benjamin's sack. They're allowed to leave. And then, they're discovered. They're stopped. And they're told, we need to search your sack. Something's come up missing. And so they begin to open the sacks and they find this silver cup in the sack of Benjamin. Look now in chapter 44, 12 and 13. Take double the money with you, carry back with you the money and return it. Take also your brother, arise and go. They've done that. We get to this point, verse 16. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, bring the men into the house, slaughter an animal. Again, gracious, merciful, kind, All of this is gracious. But soon, they're discovered. They're brought before Him. They have to give an account. They claim that they are honest men. They claim that they are not to blame. Why was not Joseph gracious earlier? He was bringing them to the end of themselves. They were still trusting in their own goodness. They were trusting in their own word. They were trusting in what they are able to accomplish. And God is bringing them to the end of themselves. This is the work of God in salvation, awaking us to the need, making us aware of the presence of God, and bringing us to the end of ourselves. Salvation comes when we quit striving. Salvation comes when we say, there is no good thing that dwells in me, and I have no hope apart from the grace, the mercy, and the working of God. And all of that is the work of God's grace. It is the work of God's hand in bringing us to salvation. It's in that that we can rejoice.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.